Morning, everyone. The Senate E-12 Division and House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Today's Wednesday, March 5, 2014. Today, we're going to focus on school facilities finance, a work group report from the Department of Education. And we are very pleased to have a joint meeting with the House. Representative Marquardt.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Wieger, and thank you so much for this meeting. And I haven't really had a chance to talk to members after our conference committee last year, but I thought that went very well. It was excellent working with you and conferees and all that. So look forward to another very good year for education. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And you know, as we set the stage for implementation and for the world's best workforce, a part of that is to have the tools, the resources, the facilities to accomplish that. 21st century facilities. Facilities that are safe, nurturing, technologically sound, state-of-the-art. And we know when we authorize the report that we're going to hear that there are some disparities in the state, and the opportunity for building facilities should not be based on zip code or wealth or combination of those factors. So we have a comprehensive report then that's been put together, and members, we're going to hear from the department representatives that have served on that task force, and we have a number of testifiers that have signed up. If you would like to testify and have not signed up, if you could please indicate to one of our respective staff persons so we can include you on the agenda. And members, tentatively, we do plan on hearing in the Senate a measure related to this on Tuesday. That's tentative, and there will be a file number, Senate file 2117, which is looking for a House jacket, by the way, or author, but it will embrace some of the discussion points that we have here. So, any questions, comments? Very good. We'll proceed, and Dr. Melcher, Rose Hermanson from the Department of Education, welcome. I see Dr. Melcher behind. He's got your back, Rose, so.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committees, thank you for having us this morning. It was my task this summer to work with the many working groups and task forces that were established at the last session, and this was one of the ones that I felt was very productive and helpful. I commend you for taking a look at facilities. Many times, as we look at education, it's one of the main areas that gets overlooked, but it's a very important one, and it's very important to take care of this infrastructure that we've established throughout the state of Minnesota. And so I think this group did an excellent job. Per the directions and statute, the working group was representative of the different groups that you identified, such as superintendents, business managers, school facilities directors, and school boards. The commissioner also appointed four at-large members, and you can see the membership of the working group on page 32 of the report if you want to know who served on it. I have sitting next to me the two co-chairs. These two co-chairs were appointed after our first meeting. They are Mark Bollinger from the Minneapolis Public Schools and Bob Indahar, superintendent of Moose Lake. If you will look at the membership, we try to be very diverse. We came from throughout the state. We had different viewpoints. We had some districts that had alternative facilities funding. Others did not. And so our attempt was to be as inclusive as possible. We also had someone from charter schools, and we also try to include other groups that we may not normally think of, such as considering co-ops and other facilities that districts are responsible for. I would also like to thank Senator Stumpf, who attended a few of the meetings, as well as Representative Seltzer, who were at many of the meetings, and Representative Quam. And so I think if you need inside experts on our discussions, feel free to go talk to them because they participated. With that, I'm turning the meeting over to our two co-chairs. They're going to outline the policy parts and some of the background discussion points, and then Dr. Melcher will come up and go through a PowerPoint that gives you much more detail on what the recommendations are. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Hermanson, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Wieger and Chair Marquardt. Thank you and good morning. I'm Mark Bollinger. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer at Minneapolis Public Schools, Special District Number 1. It's been a privilege to co-chair the School Facilities Finance Working Group and an honor to work with such a knowledgeable team of professionals dedicated to the pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. Let's stop just for a second. If you don't mind, we have a number of them in our audience that I'd like for them to raise their hands, if you would, so that you can see we're represented here today in case there's any other questions that you might have.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity to recommend solutions that will allow districts to accept the responsibility for and be given the authority to maintain and improve our district facilities to ensure all students have access to quality learning environments in Minnesota. While the individuals of the working group represent urban, suburban, rural districts, and charter schools of all size and various circumstances, the team believes as a whole that local school districts should determine the best needs for their students and be responsible for maintaining and providing the appropriate facilities. Being supported by and partnering with the state is a key component of the local district's ability to do so. In addition to representing all school districts in the state and meeting the charge of the legislature, it was easy to understand that the state and the working group were really representing the students. Minnesotans know it's more than a marketing phrase that our students are our future. Accordingly, the team's recommendation as a whole represent a long-term solution in meeting the charge to create adequate, equitable, and sustainable financing of public school facilities throughout the state. The working group is also cognizant of the various needs of the citizens of Minnesota and therefore offers 8 recommendations which together represent a holistic solution. Each of the 8 recommendations is designed to address specific issues and to clarify the fixes for those issues. Some have no cost effect. For those that carry a potential financial commitment, a plan to phase in for up to 4 years to help temper any impact is provided. We did not want to recommend a fix for one problem while creating another one that was potentially as serious. Lastly, the team worked diligently to make sure no district was harmed. It is exciting that the working group was able to develop recommendations that easily change current processes and funding options that will simplify the workloads at both the state and local levels, which may also reduce unnecessary taxpayer burdens, and that add appropriate flexibility of funds. These proposals also allow other recommendations to bring equity of funding back to the school districts so that the districts can accomplish the tasks they're willing and eager to accomplish. We understand the state must be very prudent in assigning limited funds and budgets, so we have delivered a solution to your charge for the working group. We believe the recommendations are reasonable and applicable. We unanimously recommend the acceptance of all 8 of the recommendations as an investment in our children and in the state. Education is the foundation of Minnesota, and its facilities are the physical structure. The facilities support the educational process, encourage community involvement, and physically demonstrate our commitment. Providing for and maintaining the educational facilities of the state will always be a good investment in Minnesota. Thank you. At this time, I would turn this over to Superintendent Bob Indahar.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Chair Wieger. I am Bob Indahar. I'm the Superintendent of Schools at Moose Lake, and I was honored to co-chair this committee and thankful that the legislature is willing to take a look at this issue of school financing or facility financing. I was amazed at the professionalism and the commitment of the members of this committee for problem solving what needed to be done to make funding adequate, equitable, and sustainable. As a district that struggles with dealing with their facility needs, I stand behind the recommendations of this committee. As most of you know, Moose Lake is the school that got flooded in the flood of 2012 and has been trying to find a solution for upgrading our nearly 80-year-old building and getting it off the flood-prone zone. Repeated tries at bonding in Moose Lake have been unsuccessful, which has prompted us to ask for help from the state by drafting 2 bills that are on their way through the Capitol right now. I believe the reason we need the help is basically the way school facility funding is currently distributed. It makes it nearly impossible for some districts like Moose Lake to pass a bond. The ability to pass a bond, as has been said before, should not be determined by zip code, but really it is. The recommendations in this document will go a long way to creating equity in facility financing. The key provisions that I'm most excited about in this document are, one, the equalization dollars for both long-term and short-term school facilities financing. We cannot have a state system of financing with some districts having definite advantage over other districts. Property-rich districts have a distinct advantage in receiving revenue over property-poor districts. The second point that I was excited about is to allow all districts, not just the 25, to have access to alternative facilities revenue. This is crucial. The group realized that this program is working. It works well. But how can you say that 25 districts get it and the other 300 some don't? Okay, if we're a statewide system, we need to take a serious look at that. The third thing I liked is kind of a personal one. It deals with the state's response to districts that go through a natural disaster. Right now, we're struggling. How do we deal with Rushford, Peterson, and Moose Lake? They're asking us for money. If you look at the provisions in this recommendation, it kind of outlines how the state's response could be, so that in the future, you would say to the districts that come to you, we already have this in place. Here's what our solution is. If your citizens think it's important enough, this is what we will do for you. The fourth thing, actually, that we didn't talk too much about was consolidation, but there is a piece in there that provides significant incentive for consolidation, and many people have tried to push consolidation. It's very difficult to do, but if there was incentive, that would be very helpful. And the fifth and final point that I've got that I found exciting was combining funding streams, which creates more flexibility for districts. Every district has unique needs, and the recommendations here would provide more flexibility with the monies that we get. I will tell you that there's excitement in rural Minnesota for these recommendations. I realize that these recommendations are targeted for 2017. However, I'm going to put a plug in for trying to adopt some of, if not all, of the recommendations for this session. Creating equity in financing is long overdue. Legislators have a tough job of deciding where the limited dollars of the state should be spent. And I was told, I shouldn't say state, I guess it's where the taxpayers' dollars should be spent. School facility financing is complicated, but I will tell you that there are significant inequities in how the money is doled out to districts. I would ask you to support these recommendations to bring equity back in the system of financing school facilities in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the school finance director at the Department of Education, and I provided staff support to the facilities working group. And I'm going to go through a PowerPoint that summarizes the process and the recommendations from the group. The facilities working group was established in the 2013 Omnibus Education Act. It required the Department of Education to convene the working group to develop recommendations for reforming the financing of school facilities in order to create adequate, equitable, and sustainable funding for our school facilities. The legislation required the membership to include representatives from the school superintendents, business managers, school facility directors, and school board members. There was a February 1st, 2014 deadline for the report to the legislature to be completed. The commissioner did appoint 16 members to the group, including three representatives from each of the groups outlined in law, and an additional four members that were selected by the commissioner. The group provided balanced representation from urban, suburban, and rural districts throughout the state and included a representative of the charter schools, included school districts that are currently part of the Alternative Facilities Bonding Program and schools that are not part of that program. The committee did have seven half-day meetings at the Department of Education beginning in August of 2013, and the final meeting was in January of 2014. Before the working group developed their detailed recommendations, they adopted some principles for reforming the school finance system. There were eight principles, and the first one was that funding should be adequate, equitable, and sustainable. That came directly out of the legislative charge. Second, that all districts should have access to comparable funding for comparable needs based on uniform procedures and eligibility criteria. Third, local school districts should take the lead in determining facility projects' needs, scope, and design. Fourth, funding formulas and administrative procedures should be as simple as possible so as to minimize administrative burdens and paperwork and maximize local control while providing accountability. Fifth, that property tax levies for facilities should be equalized in a manner that minimizes the variations in the revenue per student for comparable tax effort, regardless of the local tax base, and that provides stability over time. Sixth, that special provision should be made to ensure adequacy and equity for districts that have incurred facilities damage due to natural disasters. Seventh, that funding for charter schools should be comparable to funding for regular school districts. And finally, that facilities funding should promote sound long-term planning and efficient use of resources. So those were the eight principles that the committee worked with, and then they used that to develop eight detailed recommendations for changes in our funding system. And the first recommendation from the group, and probably the one that had the most discussion, had to do with long-term facilities maintenance. The committee recommended that the state establish a new long-term facility maintenance revenue program that would replace the current alternative facility program, deferred maintenance program, and health and safety programs in order to provide adequate, equitable, and sustainable long-term maintenance for all school districts through one program. They recommended a four-year phase-in for that new program, and that the phase-in be structured so that no school districts would have any loss compared to their current level of funding or state aid. The way that this phase-in was proposed to work was that in 2017, the maximum revenue for a school district, any school district in the state, would be $300 times the pupil units of the district times the lesser of one or the ratio of the average building age to 35 years. Our facilities funding formulas have long factored in the building age because we know that older buildings are more costly to maintain. And it would be the greater of the $300 per pupil or the amount that the district would have qualified for under old law. So we do have some districts that have qualified for a higher amount. They would be guaranteed to get as much as they were getting under the old law. In 2018, that $300 would grow to $400. In 2019, that number would grow to $500. And then in 2020 and after, we would take the state-imposed cap off, and all districts would have access to the alternative facilities revenue, the same as the 25 largest districts in the state currently have. The revenue would be funded with an equalized levy. The districts could choose to make that levy on a pay-as-you-go basis or on a bonded basis, just as the current alternative facility districts can do, regardless of the financing method that a district chooses. The levy would be equalized at 125% of the state average tax base per student for all districts in the state. That would maintain a constant state-local share over time as the adjusted net tax capacity changes. That 125% of the state average tax capacity is equivalent to about $8,281 per pupil based on 2015 data, but that would float as the state average adjusted net tax capacity changes in order to maintain a constant state-local share. This chart shows you the impact of the current system that we have for long-term facilities maintenance funding. We have the alternative facility revenue for the large districts. We have deferred maintenance revenue for other districts. We have health and safety revenue. And we have alternative facility revenue for large health and safety projects across the state. The way this chart is structured, the top line is the state total. Then we break this down by what we call district strata. So we have Minneapolis and St. Paul on one line, inner ring suburbs on the next line, outer ring suburbs, those that don't touch Minneapolis or St. Paul, below that. And then we have outside of the seven-county metro area, large districts over 2,000, districts between 1,000 and 2,000 students, districts under 1,000, and then charter schools. And then at the very bottom, we show what the numbers look like for districts that are in the alternative facility program currently and districts that are not eligible for the alternative facility program. So on a statewide basis, alternative facility revenue generates an average of $198 per pupil across the state. That's $450 on the average for the districts that are in the alternative facility program. The other districts don't receive funding under that revenue source. Then we have deferred maintenance, which is kind of the substitute for alternative facilities funding for districts that are not in the alternative facility program. And that averages $29 per pupil. And as you can see here, that the districts that are not eligible for alternative facilities funding receive an average of $58 per pupil. So basically, if you're in the alternative facilities program, on the average, those districts are getting $450 per pupil. If you're not in the program, you're getting, on the average, $58 per pupil for your long-term facility maintenance needs. In addition to that, we have health and safety funding, which provides an average of $54 per pupil, and that's fairly evenly spread across the different types of school districts in the state. And then the alternative facility revenue, other districts, that is where we fund health and safety projects that cost more than $500,000 per building. So districts that are not generally eligible for alternative facility revenue are allowed to levy under alternative facilities for those large health and safety projects. And you can see on the average, the districts that are not in the alternative facility program get about $93 per pupil. But if you look in the lower right-hand corner, I think that's the telling statistic for me, and that is that school districts in the alternative facility program are spending about $510 per student from all the programs combined for alternative facility costs, or for the deferred maintenance, long-term maintenance costs. School districts that are not in the program are spending on the average $212 per student. We think that the $510 per student is probably what it takes to maintain those facilities in the average school district across the state. Basically, the local school boards have set up a 10-year plan. They've determined what they think it takes to maintain their facilities and what they can afford to levy locally. And on the average, that's $510. The other school districts probably have similar needs or maybe greater needs because they haven't had access to these revenues over the years. But they're spending a little less than half of that, which would suggest to me that we've got a lot of needs that are not being met in the districts that currently are not part of the alternative facility program. So what would the recommendations of the working group do? We would take that $212 and gradually ramp that up so it would approach the level of the districts that are currently part of the alternative facility revenue program. So over a four-year period, that would grow from $212 per pupil on the average to $471 per pupil on the average. If we look at the state average funding, then when we take the level of funding in the alternative facility districts and the districts that are not in the alternative facility program, over a four-year period, the state average funding would grow from $378 in 2016 to about $555 in 2020. As far as the state's share of funding, currently the state is funding something like 7% of the cost of our long-term facilities maintenance. That does result in some inequities among school districts, where the school districts that have relatively high tax base are much better able to meet the needs for their facilities than other school districts. This would increase the state's share up to 28% of the funding, based on the equalization program that the working group recommended. So it'd still be more than 70% local property tax, but there would be a significant state share in order to minimize the differences in tax rates to generate the funding. Well, that was the first, and I think most members would agree, the most significant recommendation from the working group. The second recommendation had to do with debt service equalization. The state has equalized debt service equalization since 1993. The state legislature adopted debt service equalization in the wake of the Skeen lawsuit, which challenged the constitutionality of the state school finance system, and both the referendum equalization and debt service equalization were created in the early 1990s. What the working group is recommending is revitalizing the debt service equalization program, so it's fairly comparable to what it was back in the 90s in terms of a state share for debt service. So the committee recommended lowering the threshold to qualify for debt service equalization from 15.4% to 10% of adjusted net tax capacity. They recommended replacing our current two-tiered equalization formula with a single tiered equalization formula, with the equalization set at 125% of the state average tax base per pupil. So that would be the same as the deferred maintenance, long-term maintenance equalizing factor. They also recommended indexing the equalization in the future to maintain the state share at the same level that it would be at the beginning of this new program. And they recommended that debt service levies under the long-term maintenance program would not be included in the debt service equalization because they're already equalized under the long-term maintenance program. So what does all of that mean? Under current law, what this chart shows is the portion of revenue for school districts that is equalized by the state. So currently we have unequalized debt service levies, we have Tier 1, and we have Tier 2. Currently on a statewide total, 79% of all of the debt levies are not equalized at all by the state. They're under that 15% threshold. And Tier 1 includes about 14% of all of the tax levies, and Tier 2 includes about 6% of the tax levies. You can see that varies some among regions of the state, and also for the very low tax base districts, it doesn't take as high of a levy to get up to that tier, so that's a higher percentage of the levy is covered in the really low tax base districts. Under the proposal, when you lower the threshold from 15% to 10%, we would have 64% of the levies being unequalized, completely local property tax, and 36% being equalized by the state. So we would still have a majority of all the property tax levies for debt service unequalized, but we'd be moving up the portion that the state provides some assistance to for school districts. This next chart shows what the mix of state aid and property tax levy is within each of the tiers that we equalize. So what we have right now, Tier 1 really is not doing school districts any good. The equalization factor was set very low many years ago, and because of growth in tax base over the years, currently if you get Tier 1 equalization, on the average, the state's going to fund 1% of your debt service cost. And that's very low. It only covers school districts that are in the lowest 20%. And on the average, they only get 3% of their debt service cost funded. So in effect, Tier 1 really is meaningless. It's not providing any significant equalization of the debt levy. When you get to Tier 2, then we have a significant state share. We're funding on the average 48% of the debt service cost, which is 57% for the lowest 20% of the school districts in terms of tax base per student. So Tier 2 does provide real equalization. But remember, Tier 2 only includes 6% of the debt service revenue, so you have to have a really high tax rate to get any debt service aid at all in the current system. Under the proposal, the state would fund about 40% on the average of the debt service cost once you get over that 10% of tax capacity tax rate. So when you put all that together, what does that mean in terms of the overall state share of debt service funding? Well, if you go back to 1995, the state was funding about 11% of the debt service cost on the average. We reached a low of 1% back in 2011 in the depths of the housing crisis. The state share has come up to about 3% now as a result of declining values of homes over the last several years. But this would restore the state share of debt service to 14%, so it would be roughly equivalent, slightly higher than the debt service equalization state share that we had back in 1993. Okay, the third recommendation of the working group was to take a look at the building lease levy. Currently, school districts are allowed to levy up to $162 per pupil for building leases, which could be anything from adding on an addition onto an existing building for all-day kindergarten, as an example, to leasing ice time for the hockey team. There are a whole variety of uses that school districts make of the building lease levy. What this recommendation would do would be to replace the school building lease levy with a new facilities improvement revenue that would have broader uses than the building lease levy. We would still allow districts to use it for building leases, just as they do now. But we would add to that the ability to use that money for other things that would include remodeling and enhancing safety and security. So if a school district needs to remodel the entrance to their building in order to provide a safe environment for their students, right now you couldn't use the lease levy for that, but this would allow you to use that amount of money to take care of some of those unmet needs that school districts have with their existing facilities. The group also recommended that an adjustment be made in the size of the levy from $162 to $180. So basically what we're looking at is a little bit bigger pot and then broadening the uses so that it includes some remodeling of existing facilities, both for safety and security needs and also to enhance the learning environment. We may have science labs that are 80 years old in some school districts. This would allow a school district to take that limited amount of money, up to $180 per pupil unit, and make a choice. We can use it for leases or we can use it to take care of these security issues and enhancing our instructional environment. This levy also would be equalized at 125% of the state average tax base per student. So the current building lease levy that we have right now across the state, it's $52 million. We also have an additional lease levy for school districts that are members of an intermediate district, which is up to $46 per pupil unit, that allows school districts that are members of an intermediate to maintain the buildings or to lease buildings for the intermediate school districts. That's about $6 million. So on the average, the actual lease levy is about $65 per pupil. So most school districts are well under the $162 maximum. We do have a few districts at the limit, but there is some room there that school districts could continue to do what they're doing in terms of leases and then also do things like improving the security of their facilities. The proposed facility improvement revenue that would replace that would include a regular component of $180 per pupil. It would also continue to have a cooperative component. This would apply, though, not only to the intermediate school districts, but other cooperatives. We have many school districts across the state that, for example, are members of a special education cooperative. So currently, the intermediate districts can levy for lease costs, but other cooperatives that may have a similar mission in terms of addressing special education needs or career technical needs do not have access to the same kind of ability. This would add that to, again, provide more uniformity across the state. Under this proposal, if all of the school districts were to levy at the maximum, we don't think they all would, but if they all levied at the maximum, it would be $180 per pupil across the state. It's an average increase of $131 per pupil, and the recommendations would be to provide funding for charter schools of $131 so that they would be receiving a comparable increase as compared to school districts. With the equalization, the state aid component of this would be about $55 million. The next recommendation from the group was to take a look at the capital project referendum. The capital project referendum is currently used primarily in suburban school districts to address technology needs, but it can be used for any range of capital facility kinds of needs. The recommendation here is to equalize the levy. So school districts would still have to go to the voters to pass this if they want to basically have a capital referendum. But the difference here would be by providing equalization at the same level as the equalization recommended for these other levies, we'd be leveling the playing field. So the property poor districts would have the same access to the capital project levy as the property wealthy districts. The next recommendation was for the operating capital revenue. That provides for the day-to-day needs of school districts in terms of regular ongoing kind of shorter-term small facility maintenance projects. That funding formula has been constant for many years. School districts have lost a lot of buying power because it has not been adjusted for inflation, despite growing needs for technology, as an example. The current formula is $79 per adjusted pupil unit plus $109 per adjusted pupil unit multiplied by a building age factor, plus $31 per year-round pupil unit. And the recommendation was to increase that to $100 per pupil unit plus $120 per pupil adjusted for the building age factor. So there would be an increase in the level of operating capital revenue for all school districts, and the equalization of that would also be improved. So what would that look like? This chart shows the inflation-adjusted level of funding per student that we have for operating capital programs. If we go back to 2003 and we convert that to constant dollars, funding was about $325 per student on the average. It has dropped to about $245 per student. This would raise it up to $284. So it's not replacing all of the lost buying power, but it's making a step in that direction. As far as the state's share of operating capital funding, in 2003 and 2004, the state funded 100% of the cost of operating capital. That was part of the state takeover of levies back in the Ventura years as part of the big plan. Then when the state had some budget crises, we've been gradually lowering the state's share of operating capital revenue. We reached a low of 35% in 2011. The 2013 legislature did make some progress in improving that. We're now up to 56%. The committee recommendations would raise that to about 80% state share. So we're not all the way back to 2003, but we're moving in the direction of providing some tax relief on the operating capital program. The next recommendation from the group had to do with districts that have unique needs. And we currently have a program called the Cooperative Facilities Grant Program. And the state did issue several grants in the 1990s to school districts that were consolidating that needed a new facility. So the Grant County districts, there was one in Lackey Parl. The last grant that was approved was in 1994. The current program doesn't work very well. It's on the books. We haven't funded one since 1994. What this would do would be to replace that grant program with an enhanced debt service equalization formula for districts that have one of three conditions. One of them would be they have a significant unfunded natural disaster. Now, quite often when we have a natural disaster, there's a bill and that takes care of the need. So this wouldn't kick in unless the district actually had significant unfunded needs, but it's kind of a backstop in case there wasn't special legislation adopted to address those needs. They would get a higher state share of debt equalization in that case. A second one is for school district consolidations, and this was the original purpose of the facilities grant program. So this would say that if school districts are planning a consolidation, but in order to do that, they need to do some significant remodeling of the building to address their facility needs to make the consolidation work, that they also could qualify for an enhanced rate of debt service equalization. And the third piece would be for school districts that have unusually high debt service needs. So right now, the program that we have for districts that have unusually high debt service needs is a capital loan. And that only applies to very unusual circumstances like Red Lake. But we have other districts that have very high debt service levies, but they don't quite reach the level of needing a special bill and the bonding bill to do that. This would kind of fill that gap. Another recommendation, I believe it's the last recommendation from the group, was to reform the review and comment process. Anytime a school district wants to do any kind of construction project that's more than $1.4 million, They've got to go through a very detailed, lengthy, laborious process with the Department of Education and get the commissioner to sign off on a review and comment. We have not had changes in that for a number of years. The recommendation from this group was to do some reform. And the first recommendation was to increase the dollar threshold for review and comment from $1.4 million to $2 million. That's basically adjusting for inflation. A $2 million school project is not a huge project any longer, and we don't believe that the time and paperwork of a review and comment is warranted for a project that's under $2 million. The second would be to eliminate review and comment for projects that are funded entirely with long-term maintenance revenue, facilities improvement revenue, or operating capital revenue. In the case of long-term maintenance revenue, those are projects that are currently funded with health and safety or deferred maintenance. They already have a plan that's reviewed by the department, so review and comment is kind of redundant and involves more paperwork than necessary. So we can reduce some paperwork by doing that. In the case of operating capital revenue, it's a fixed dollar per pupil unit. It's just part of their budget. The department shouldn't have to do a detailed review of what they're spending operating capital revenue for. The committee also recommended reducing paperwork for the remainder of the review and comment process. We have some detailed bill language in here, and also eliminating the consultation requirement for smaller projects. Right now, the law says any school district that has a project of more than $500,000 has to consult with the department before they proceed. So if you want to spend $700,000 replacing, you know, the carpeting in the building or something like that, you've got to consult with the department. Well, right now that's a pretty meaningless requirement. The district sends a letter to the department saying, we're going to do this project for $700,000. The department sends a letter back saying, oh, okay, good. And, you know, so we've got more paperwork and really haven't accomplished anything. So we think we could eliminate that requirement for the smaller projects under $2 million. With respect to charter schools, the committee recommended providing funding increases for charter schools that were comparable to the increases for school districts. So charter schools would receive a long-term maintenance allowance of $59 per pupil unit in fiscal 17 that would ramp up to $163. That would match the increase on the average for school districts, and also that they receive a facility improvement allowance of $163 per pupil unit. So basically, charter schools would have the same average increase as school districts. For cooperatives, the committee recommended expanding the allowable uses of the lease levy for members of intermediate districts, consistent with the facilities improvement program. So intermediate district could use that for remodeling their buildings as well as leasing new space. So it just allows more flexibility in the use of that levy, and also extending the authority to include special education cooperatives and other cooperative units. Secondly, recommendation was to allow member school boards of intermediate districts and cooperatives to include a proportionate share of the intermediate or co-op costs in the district's long-term maintenance program. So if a school district wants to use some of their long-term maintenance revenue to fix the roofs at the intermediate or the co-op, they could choose to do that as part of their long-term maintenance program. What's the fiscal impact if all of these recommendations were adopted? It's significant, because there are significant facility funding issues in the schools. Under the committee recommendations, the total revenue impact would be $206 million in 2017, $250 million in 2018, and $301 million in 2019. The way that these were structured, there would be no increase in state total property tax levies. But levies would increase for some districts and go down for other districts, so the full cost of this would be funded from the state budget. The initial modeling,
and there might be sticker shock, that's 25% less than the Vikings stadium, as to be for the entire state. Put it in perspective.
For 330 school districts around the state.
Yes.
The initial modeling that we did here was rough modeling. If the legislature were to move forward with some of these recommendations, we would need to do some more detailed analysis. In some cases, we just looked at what was the maximum that school districts could qualify for, not knowing exactly what the actual proposals would be that school districts would come up with. This last chart, I don't know, maybe kind of small and hard to read, but let me refer you to the actual report. I think that might be helpful. So you've got a copy of the report in front of you, and if you go just past page 16 of the report, there are a set of tables, and these provide more detail than the tables that I walked through with you. But if you go back all the way to report number 10, and there's not a page number, I apologize for that. But that says page 11 of the tables. But okay, so if you go to page 13 of the tables, it says report 10 at the top. Have you got that?
We're getting it.
I've got report one.
Okay, so if you go to report one, keep going back. There are 10 reports. And go back until you see report 10 at the top.
We're there.
Okay, so report 10, what this shows is what the cost of the recommendations would be after the full phase-in, broken down by the program. So the first set of recommendations has to do with long-term maintenance. And you'll see if you add up all the programs, deferred maintenance, health and safety, alternative facilities, we currently have $302 million of revenue, including $23 million of aid, $278 million of levy under the proposal. You can see that would grow to $451 million, so the increase would be $149 million. And the way the phase-in works, it's basically $50 million the first year, another $50 million the second year, and another $50 million the third year. So we're over 3 years, we'd be ramping up to a $150 million increase in long-term facility maintenance to basically eliminate the gap between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to long-term maintenance. And also, this would greatly simplify the system. We'd eliminate all of the applications for health and safety and all that because it would be part of the deferred maintenance program. Then the capital project referendum. What you can see, that's about $57 million. Under the recommendations, we would be not making a change in revenue, but the state aid through equalization would be about $7 million, reducing levy by $7 million. Then under facility improvement, you can see the current building lease levy is about $59 million. Under this proposal, that would grow to $178 million. This is a significant change that would allow school districts to use that lease levy not only for leases but for remodeling facilities for security and for improved instructional environments. That could be as much as $119 million increase, about half of which would be aid and half of which would be levy. In operating capital, we're looking at a $32 million increase, $71 million aid increase, a $38 million reduction in levy. No change in charter school lease aid. Debt service aid would grow by about $65 million, replacing levy. So bottom line here, you're looking at $301 million of state aid, and the net property tax levy would be the same as it currently is when fully phased in if you were to adopt the entire set of recommendations from the working group. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that is the overview of the working group recommendations. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Dr. Melcher, thank you for an excellent overview, as always. And to co-chairs Bollinger and Inda Hart, thank you for your leadership on the task force. For those members that are in attendance as well, we deeply appreciate your efforts during the interim. We'll field questions amongst members for about the next 10 minutes. Then we're going to open it up for testimony from five persons that have signed up, and we'll ask those persons to try to capsulize their testimony within 5 minutes as we plan to adjourn at 9:45. We're going to go to Representative Markhart, Representative Grunhagen, and Senator Bonhoff in that order. Representative Markhart.
Well, thank you very much. I want to echo Senator Wieger's comments. This is just an excellent, thorough report. Thank you to all who have been involved with this. And it addresses these huge needs that we have around the state with facilities. And it also, I think, probably the most important part, is going to create more uniformity among all the districts, and also providing districts with a lot more flexibility on how to use those dollars. I mean, this is, I think all of us, when we've talked to our school districts, this is what we have heard. So I just applaud this task force for addressing those needs. I just have a couple questions on the finances. If I understand this, on the fiscal impact, and I think Dr. Melcher, you referred to that, that $50 million roughly every year that you had on chart number 29 of the increase is primarily because of the long-term maintenance phase-in of 50 each year. Is that where you see the, it goes from 206 to 250 to 301 ultimately. Is that primarily the phase-in of the long-term maintenance, and are the other areas pretty much flat in funding, I suppose, except for the indexing each of the years in that? I guess that's
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, yes. The all of the other recommendations are fully phased in right away, and the one piece that is phased in over 4 years would be the deferred maintenance, long-term maintenance piece, yes.
Thank you. And just one more question for Mr. Bollinger or Superintendent Indahar. I think I heard you say this, but if we were to phase this in, I mean, it's a pretty big chunk, although as Senator Wieger mentioned, just little parts of other public financing things that we've done. What would be your number one priority? Is the long-term maintenance? I mean, what if we had to start with one of these areas, what would you select as first? We had to phase it in.
I think we'd have different answers, but I think the equalization for us is a big deal, and to have access to that alt funding dollars for Moose Lake.
Okay.
So from Minneapolis Public Schools perspective, we do have access to the alt facilities funding, and we do take advantage of that. So we do acknowledge that it's very important that we try to combine some of those other levies or the revenues together into a common fund, but ours would be much different than the others.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for the excellent presentation, Director Melcher. I served on a school board over a period of time, and the thing is, I've got a couple questions for you. First is, you know, I see some of the graphs, like on page 9 and the other ones, where the state is starting to take over a larger share of the maintenance cost. Now, if I remember right, under the Ventura administration, we had a similar situation where the state took over a lot more of the funding for the local school districts, and we actually had a nice property tax reduction. The problem is, as the years went by, the graph started going the other way again. Okay, the state started shifting more and more back to the local school district, and picked up less and less. So, you know, you put these promises out to school districts, and unfortunately, they're subject to economic and tax revenue conditions, and politicians being what they are, and I won't expand on that comment, when crisis hits, they start, should we say stealing or cheating? No, just reducing is probably a better word, different areas in order to try to balance the budget. You know, that's a concern. And then you've got everything indexed to inflation. And I certainly agree that the maintenance coming from a outstate older facility district, that maintenance is a problem. So the other question I have, and you don't have, you know, I just stated that for an overview as far as the Ventura situation, is this money has to be spent on facilities, or can districts get waivers or drain some of it into the general fund in any way, or is it locked in as a bucket? You know, districts always say, give us the flexibility, just give us the money and give us the flexibility. Well, I've seen how that works. It all goes towards settlements, you know, salary and benefits and additional programs, and then there's no money to fix the facilities, which is basically confirmed by your report. And then they go to the public and say, by the way, the facilities are falling apart, give us more tax revenue. And when you pass that, most of that money goes for salary and benefits and programs, and very little gets spent on the facilities, it seems.
Representative Grugan, may they respond?
Yep, and I am ending my question here real quick.
Okay.
So Do they? Is it locked in to have to be spent on facility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunewald, there are several different categories of facility revenue. The recommendation dealing with deferred maintenance, that money by state law can only be used for deferred maintenance of buildings, for health and safety, and the facilities improvement revenue, which is currently the building lease levy, could only be used for building leases, which they currently can use it for, or for remodeling of buildings to take care of issues like school safety and security or improve learning environments. So those sources of revenue can only be used to fix up buildings. One area where there is some debt service revenue also, that can only be used for debt service on your bonds for your buildings. The one area where there is some flexibility locally is the operating capital area, where school districts can use that for facilities maintenance, but they can also use that money for technology and for staff that keep the technology running. So that is the one area where there's a little bit more flexibility. The other ones are specifically, purely, and simply just for facilities.
Mr. Grunhager, we're going to field a few other questions. I need to get to the testifiers before we run out of time.
Okay.
So we'll
one quick follow-up. Is the local taxpayers get to vote on this, or are these are automatic levies that the school district can do?
Dr. Melcher?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Grunewald, the debt service equalization component of this, that's for voter-approved debt service. But the other components are things that the local school board can vote to do.
Thank you.
And Senator Barna, followed by Representative McDonald, and if we could ask the first few, the next testifiers to be on deck right behind. Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Melcher, thank you for the presentation. As we look at the bonding bill this year, and we look at the amount that we put in for HEPR for higher ed, which is essentially the making sure that we're, you know, keeping all of the maintenance for our higher ed institutions in line, why is it that we don't consider these types of things for our school districts? Whatever was the decision that had us not put that in a systematic process in our bonding bill?
Dr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, I would say that it's the fact that we have 330 school districts, and it would just be very cumbersome and difficult to pass a bill that had line items for individual school districts. Some states do have more of a state-directed funding system, and usually if they do that, the legislature has appointed members to a commission that would then review the projects. The state might award a certain amount of bonding, and then the commission would then kind of rank order all of the projects. But in Minnesota, we've always been more of a local control state, so the idea has traditionally been we want the individual school boards that are the closest to the needs, identify what those needs are, and then have the local communities weigh in.
And then I'll be brief. I can appreciate that, but wouldn't the funding mechanism, you know, right now, just as I understand it, the large districts get to bond for these dollars? Given these are things that have long-time value, wouldn't the use of bonding, whether or not we do it locally or not, still be advantageous versus a pay-as-you-go?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoff, absolutely, and the recommendations from the work group would allow the long-term maintenance revenue to be handled either through pay-as-you-go or bonding. Okay. And that's what we currently do with the alternative facility dollars for the large 25 districts. Some choose all bonding, some choose all pay-as-you-go, some do a combination. Under this recommendation, all of the school districts in the state could do that that same thing. But it wouldn't be in the state bonding bill. It would be locally determined.
I understand. Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question for Dr. Melcher. I think that we as a state have made some mistakes where we put too much money into bricks and mortar. You go around to the school districts, you see some pretty snazzy schools instead of into the education, into the classroom, the teachers, and the curriculum. So I see that as a mistake, and hopefully that we can rectify that in the future. And I'm not suggesting that we let our buildings run amok. We need to continue to maintain them and make sure they have good, proper working order for our students and for our buildings.
So that's Sam McDonald. That's a local control issue on the buildings.
Yes, it is, Senator. So anyway, Doctor, as I was saying, in your suggestions, in the suggestions and the recommendations from your committee, and I'll dig into it a little bit deeper as well and share that with my school boards and my district and my superintendents to get to see what they have to say about it as well. Does it allow for monies to be used for niceties or just some needs, not necessarily wants? And you suggested that a little bit, but if you could expand on that, that we're not putting too much money into bricks and mortars and amenities that should the money should be going to the classroom.
Mr. Chairman and Representative McDonald, the current structure that we have for accountability is one where we have a requirement for a review and comment on any project that is over $1.4 million. We're recommending $2 million. And essentially that requires the school district to come up with a detailed rationale for why they need to do the project. That gets reviewed by the commissioner. The commissioner needs to do a positive, negative review and comment. If it's a positive review and comment, then the school board needs to go to the voters to get that approved by at least 50% of the taxpayers, and the commissioner will do the review and comment based on whether she believes that the proposal is economically and educationally sound. So that's kind of our current structure. What this proposal does primarily would be to improve the equalization of levies that have been through that process. They've gone to voter approval, and we're going to equalize those levies now so that the property poor school districts have the same opportunity to build buildings that have received voter approval as the property wealthy districts. The other side of this is whether the state should maintain what we've already got out there. And that's where the deferred maintenance piece of this comes into play, where we have a lot of deteriorating buildings out there. So once we've been through the voter approval process on any new buildings, what this group is saying is that we should have a way for the school districts to maintain what they got. That's what deferred maintenance is. It's replacing the roof that's leaking or that's worn out, replacing the other aspects of the building as they age. So basically it's all about maintaining the investment in what we already have.
Senator, quick follow-up.
We're not going to have time for that, for any additional follow-up now in respect to our testifiers. I mentioned earlier it's going to be up next week in the Senate and the House. There'll be additional opportunity. But Dr. Melcher, co-chairs, we will now go to our testifiers, and if you could be on call as needed. Thanks again for your excellent presentations. If we could ask our three testifiers listed in order, Superintendent Connie Hayes, Heather Nelson, and Carol Nielsen to approach, and the remaining two will follow. And welcome, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Connie Hayes, Superintendent, Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. And I, too, want to commend the task force members, the leadership, for the really great work they've done with their recommendations. I have had the unique experience of serving as a superintendent in northern Minnesota, southern Minnesota, and now in an intermediate district. I also worked for a short time with the public finance group. So I think I've got some unique perspectives and really commend the group that they've come up with some great recommendations that will create some good facilities all across the state. I'm here representing all three of the intermediates, 916, 917, and 287. The intermediate school districts have needs in long-term facilities that are not adequately provided for in current state and funding streams. Although the intermediates originally had taxing authority, we no longer do, and now work through our member districts for that taxing authority. From the enabling legislation, when the intermediates were formed by the legislature, there does remain the option to hold simultaneous referenda campaigns to meet our facility needs. However, we've chosen not to do that given the impracticality of running success campaigns in all of our member districts at the same time. Before I share the two critical elements that we feel we need, it is also critical for the committee to understand a couple of things. Our member districts do want to support us in the repair of our facilities and take care of those investments, but they do not want us to do so in a member that would cause an annual spike in their local levies. The intermediate school districts use a financing tool called Certificates of Participations, or COP, which allow us to make deferred payments on large projects and thus minimize the spikes in our annual members' levies. So instead of paying for the entire mortgage at once, COPs allow you to pay over time. And it should be noted, members of the committee, that COPs require an annual appropriation by all the member school districts. So there are two critical components to ensure our capacity to maintain our facilities over the long term. One, expand the allowable use of lease levy authority to include not only building leases, but also facility modifications, enhancing school safety, security, remodeling of existing space, and building additions for instructional purposes. Our member districts have authority, as Dr. Melcher mentioned, of $46 per adjusted pupil unit for these leases. Expanding the intermediate's authority for use of the lease levy authority is consistent with recommendation number 4 in the report. And the intermediates are called out specifically in the report for that. The second critical component is not called for in the report. And that recommendation for the legislature to consider would be to remove the cap of $500,000 for health and safety projects and allow the intermediates to use this financing tool of COPs to pay for those large projects. As I said, this isn't called out in the report. However, the comparable recommendation for this in the report is recommendation number 1, which establishes that new long-term facilities maintenance revenue, which includes health and safety for the K-12 districts. So in effect, the K-12 districts will be able to sell bonds. They call them GO bonds against that revenue stream. Right now, none of us can sell bonds against that revenue stream. So I think it's analogous to that revenue stream if you could allow the intermediates to sell COPs against health and safety. We would recommend that you maintain the health and safety program specifically for the intermediate school districts. And it's important to allow the districts to be able to coordinate the needs of a specific building that includes a large chunk of health and safety and a large chunk of deferred maintenance. We have a building in Little Canagall called Capital View Center. Some of you have probably been there over the years. It's very old, 1956 version, and it's dying. And so our board has to decide if they're going to fix that building or replace it. And we obviously have no revenue stream right now at all to fix that building, so we are going to need some assistance. So those two critical pieces are very important for us. One last thing I'd like to address quickly on Dr. Melcher's presentation, the second bullet for the cooperatives that says to allow member school boards of intermediate district co-ops to include a proportionate share of intermediate co-op costs in the district's long-term maintenance revenue. I think that's a great idea. It's complicated. Our member districts would have to infuse our needs into their long-term plans. Having been a K-12 district superintendent, I know how hard that is to do just for your own district. And on top of that, if they were going to try to sell bonds for our needs, when I worked for the public finance group, we never saw that, where a school district would sell bonds and send the proceeds to another entity. So we're afraid, you know, in terms of combining bond sales for a local district and an intermediate in a single bond sale, we would probably, in effect, raise the interest costs for the member district in that bond sale, and it would be difficult to separate out what should be our costs and what should be our member district costs. Not impossible, and it would certainly take some more study to be able to accomplish that, but I see some big challenges moving forward. I think our member districts would really prefer that the revenues for us are kept separate from the revenues of their particular needs, and actually have one of our member districts' business managers here. You could ask her opinion on that if she has time to answer that question. Thank you very much for your attention today.
Thank you, Superintendent Hayes. Ms. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Heather Nosen, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Educational Facilities Management Professionals, otherwise known as MASMIS. I am in my 10th year at the Rosemount Apple Valley Eagan School District, where I'm currently the Alternative Facilities Project Manager. I, along with two other members of MASMIS, served on the working group, Finance Working Group. As Dr. Melcher pointed out, there were several recommendations made by the working group, and as an organization representing over half of the school districts in the state, MASMS completely supports the recommendations in this report. We are eager to see the recommendation for the review and comment policy favorably acted upon this session. But what I would like to focus your attention on today is the first recommendation in the report, which can be found on page 6. In order to provide adequate, equitable, and sustainable maintenance funding for all school districts, we ask that you replace the current maintenance funding and establish a new long-term maintenance revenue program. It's critical that we start thinking about this now so that we have a plan in place when you come back in 2015. I am not going to claim to be an expert in the complex world of school finance, but what I can speak to is the positive impact alternative facilities has had in our district. We are the fourth largest district in the state, and we are able to use alternative facilities funding for many, many things. If one of our 38 buildings has a roof leak, it's our district standard that that leak is permanently repaired within a 24-hour period. And I don't just mean hanging a bucket above some ceiling tile to catch the drips. And when the time comes to replace the roof, we have a plan in place and a budget to do so. We have also been able to significantly reduce our heating, ventilation, and air conditioning failures because we are able to maintain those units. And last but not least, the aesthetics of our buildings, both interior and exterior. Because we receive ALT facilities funding, we're able to maintain our properties. When our community members and students walk into our buildings, they would never guess that the average age is close to 30 years. We have a very consistent appearance throughout our district. By minimizing school day disruptions, we have a direct impact on the ability for students to concentrate in the classroom. As Dr. Melcher pointed out, there is a significant gap between ALT facility districts and non-ALT facility districts. On average, a non-ALT facility district receives $212 in funding compared to an ALT facility district receives $510. That's a $298 difference in maintenance funding. If you take the average size school district in the state of about 2,500 enrolled students, that's $750,000 per year in maintenance costs. MASMS wholeheartedly believes that school facilities desperately need your help. Our kids deserve the very best schools to learn in each and every day, and facilities that are equal in quality. And we believe this report is that roadmap. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Nielsen.
Yes, good morning. My name is Carol Nielsen, Director of Finance at Moundsview Public Schools. Moundsview serves about 10,000 students, and we manage 13 school facilities with total square footage over 1.8 million. And approximately half of our school buildings were built back in the 1950s. And so deferred maintenance is always an important component. I support all of the recommendations of the School Facilities Finance Working Group. I'd just like to share a couple of points that I feel strongly about. The working group's recommendation number one, that provides funding for all school districts statewide, is critically important to the aging facilities in our Minnesota school systems. Moundsview Schools is fortunate to be able to access that funding. We were able to do that when we had the support of our residents and we had a bond that allowed us to increase our square footage and therefore became eligible for all facilities because of our size and age of buildings. Since we were eligible in 2004, we've accessed this funding as a pay-as-you-go, and our 10-year plan has allowed us to address the deteriorating roofs, deteriorating parking lots, boiler systems, and windows. And these are the types of components that typically don't sell well in a bond referendum, and so the funding mechanism has been excellent. At the same time, we are very, very mindful of the tax impact for our residents with this annual alternative facilities levy, and we plan for that spending so that we can hopefully keep that as stable as possible over a time period. So it's been an extremely important and sustainable funding stream for us, and I think it would definitely serve the state well to make that available to all schools. The second point is the working group recommendation number five of increasing the operating capital allowance and indexing it for inflation. This is a change that's long past due. It hasn't had any significant change since 2003. Yet the need and the demand, as you've heard, is steadily increased. Our operating capital revenue remained constant at about $2.4 million over that time period. Back in 2003, it represented about 2.2% of our budget. It's dropped now to only about 1.7% of our budget. We spend approximately half of that funding, $1.2 million, annually to replace and upgrade our technology infrastructure and technology devices so that our students can be 21st century learners in a competitive global world. We are also excited that we're able to use some of that resources to provide some remodeling to address the space issues for the kindergarten centers that are going to be welcomed into our school district next year. But again, because of the limitation, we have to use operating capital to do that. We can't use of any of the others, and so the lease levy component would help address that issue. And so while we've been addressing all of those important issues, our other capital needs, such as textbooks and furniture and maintenance and operation vehicles, they tend to continue to get squeezed into smaller buckets. So you can see that it's been a very challenging funding mechanism. We thank you for your time, and we really look forward to a positive review of this legislation and look forward to some changes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Nielsen.
You're welcome.
Next, we'll ask Superintendent Jett as well as Scott Kroonquist to join us. And if there's anyone else, we will try to squeeze you in, time permitting. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Wieger and Chair Marquardt. As you can see, this is not Scott Kroonquist. That one is.
Thank you.
I'm Dan Jett of the West Metro Education Program, and with me is Mike Volna, who is board member in St. Anthony New Brighton Public Schools, and he also serves on our Joint Powers Board as our treasurer. We're pleased to take just a few minutes today to share our interest with you, and I'm not going to read to you what is being distributed, but I would ask you to please take a look at it. It is the essence of why we're here. We're not looking for special treatment, but we're looking for inclusion. When you read the report, you'll see reference to intermediate districts, to co-ops, to education districts, to charter schools. What you won't find is a reference to joint powers school districts. And we are, in fact, Joint Powers District 6069. If you'll turn the page of the document I just gave you, there's two photographs, and they are photographs of the two schools that we operate. They're both known as Fair School. One is Fair School Downtown, located at 10th and Hennepin. If you've gone to the theater, you've seen it. It's right across the street. The other school is in Crystal, in the Robbinsdale Area School District. These schools were built with state bonding money back in the late 90s, early 2000s. The data is included in the handout you have. And unfortunately, there is no mechanism for deferred maintenance for these two facilities. And so our request is that we be included in whatever consideration you give or whatever bill ultimately may this year or some year find its way out, that these two facilities are maintained in the same spirit as all other state facilities. So it's not that we're looking for special treatment. Quite frankly, we think the committee's proposal to address intermediate district needs probably fit us quite well. However, we're quite open to other mechanisms if committees feel there's a better way to do it. Our schools are now 14 and 16 years old. We don't have an immediate deferred maintenance need tomorrow, but as you know, life cycle of building systems do come into play eventually, and we'd like to get a funding stream in place so that when that occurs, it doesn't create a calamity for us that we have to hurry up and find a quick fix. With that, I'll ask Mr. Volna to add any comments he might have.
Thank you. Chairs and members of the committee, thank you very much. As a 22-year school board member of the St. Anthony New Brighton School District, I'm comfortable with the financing mechanism that I understand is being proposed in the report. I can say that speaking for my fellow board members who are appointed to the WEMEP board, we recognize that these two buildings are assets that need to be preserved. We also acknowledge that there is no way to do it because WEMEP has no ability to issue debt, and even if we could, we have no way to pay for it because we can't levy or tax. So there needs to be a mechanism to provide for the long-term repairs and sustainment of these buildings. We think, as Dan said, that the report will effectively address much of what we need if you provide for consideration of WEMEP in that. So we would encourage you to do that, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and for your quarter of a century of service on the local board. Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, or committees, I should say. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to offer some comments in strong support of the recommendations that you just heard. I think the recommendations have broad support in the education community, and that is no easy task, as you all know. Sometimes getting the various education groups to agree on the color of the sky is a challenge, and in this case, I think there's unanimous support. I'm not trying to speak for every group, but I know of no group that does not support these recommendations. We think the report is an excellent complement to the work that you did last year, approving full-day kindergarten, expanding early learning, legislation to create the world's best workforce. As you all know, now districts are scrambling to make sure they got the classroom space to implement full-day K, to expand early learning programs, and this goes hand in hand. So we're excited about this proposal. Hope you will look favorably upon it. And Mr. Chairman and members, as I was cleaning files this last fall, came across a couple reports. One's from 1998, Planning Now for 21st Century Community School Facilities. It was a report to the Senate K-12 Education Budget Division, submitted by the K-12 Subcommittee on School Facilities and Infrastructure. Another excellent report, by the way. That was followed up a year later by recommendations of the K-12 Facilities and Infrastructure Task Force, and this came out in January of 1999. And members, if you look through these two reports, it's remarkable the similarity and the issues that were addressed then that are in the current report. They were talking about expanding alternative facilities authority, technology, lease levy, debt service equalization. So members, I think we've admired the problem long enough. We think it's time to take action and move forward on these important recommendations. So thank you for your the opportunity to testify, and we look forward to working with you. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Mr. Grunquist, and you know, those were committees that I chaired, as you know. reports should not gather dust, but momentum. So here we are today, and let's make it happen. We will take some additional testimony, perhaps a minute or two each.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, shouldn't take more than 30 seconds. Schools for Equity, Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity Education, very, very strong supporters of this report. As Mr. Kroonquist said, it's very rare that you'll get the kind of broad support across the education community that this report certainly has elicited. I would say that increased access to facilities funding and equalized access, every time you hear the word equalization, think of me. And when you think of increased equalization, make the picture bigger. So I think the thing is we really look at this report as a great leap forward in terms of resources for school districts, and we're in full support of it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Jim Grathwell, Minneapolis Public Schools. Scott Grunquist has a better filing system than I do. Brad Lundell has better jokes than I do. I'll just say we strongly support the report. We urge you to enact it this session. Take these recommendations and run with them. We appreciate the work of the committee and the co-chairs, and Mr. Melcher, Dr. Melcher, and Assistant Commissioner Hermanson. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Mary Sucone, Parents United. I guess I joined the crowd. This is long overdue. We remember the reports that you first got, and please enact this. We need this. This is what we talk about, statewide sustainability, equitability, adequacy. We need schools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members, since we're doing this morning, I hadn't planned on coming up, but Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. We've got 175 district members across greater Minnesota. You did a lot of work last year to improve equity in the education system on the operating side. You've still got some work to do there. We want to work with you on that. But we see this as the next phase of equity in the school system. And I think in the report that Dr. Melcher put out, you saw some differential between how much per square foot districts in the alternative facility program are able to invest in their deferred maintenance compared to those who are not. And that's almost a 5-to-1 differential. And that is a major inequity that is unaddressed, and we support Senator Wieger's efforts over the years, and now Dr. Melcher's report, and we hope you take action on it soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Denise Dietrich of the Minnesota School Boards Association. Grace Kelleher from the Minnesota School Boards Association participated on the committee and obviously a part of the vote of support since the vote was unanimous on that work group. And her comments about the way that the group performed were stellar all the way along. Dr. Melcher, along with Rose Hermanson, led the group very proficiently. And we would just like to say that we are so pleased that they addressed some of the long-term plaguing issues in the inequity in facilities across the state. The first, obviously, is closing the equity gap in those who receive long-term alternative facilities funding and those that don't. The one thing that I would like to mention is that school boards members across the state are really pleading for resources to make their schools safe. Those who have those school districts that have access to to alternative facilities have flexibility in doing that. Redesigning their front entries, putting in bulletproof glass, those types of things, and a student should be in a safe school no matter where they live in the state. So every school district in the state needs to be able to reassess their safety concerns and address them. Our only disappointment is that we're not going to act on it this year. But maybe, who knows, by the end of session what might happen. And so we want to really encourage you to take a strong look at the recommendations and see if we can't start the process this year so that school boards can at least start the planning, because construction-type activities take a long time to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Dietrich. Again, on behalf of the House Senate committees, I'd like to thank the Department of Education for their leadership, Ms. Hermanson, Dr. Melcher, and just an outstanding report. And we couldn't have asked for a more comprehensive vision with how we could roll that out. And as I mentioned, the Senate will be taking up some of the recommendations next week, tentatively Tuesday at 8:30. Thank you to each of the testifiers, and for others that have comments, questions, there will be opportunity in the near future. Representative Marquardt, any committee announcements?
Well, thank you. Mr. Kroonquist held up a couple splots, strategic plans languishing on the shelf. Hopefully we can avoid that with this report. But again, thank you so much for all of you who worked on this report. And one announcement for House Education Finance, we will be moving on House File 2480, Representative Selzer's bill tomorrow. So amendments are, deadline is due at 2 p.m. today, just a reminder. So thank you, Senator Wieger. Thank you, Senate members.
Thank you. Committee members, the meeting's adjourned.